We just launched into the Gospel of Matthew. We're going to be focusing on the things that Jesus says throughout the Gospel. Just into the start of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5-7. We just want to consider today the next couple of things that Jesus says in that sermon. Last week we considered the Beatitudes, which is how Jesus starts. And I suggested that you might imagine those Beatitudes as being like a set of posters that Jesus gives to you to hang up in the room of your soul. So that if I could enter into your soul like somebody walks into a room, or I might say, hey, why do you have a picture on the wall of somebody who's poor in spirit? Or how did you decide to put up a picture of a merciful person? In your answer back to me, were I to see those pictures and ask, why did you hang that up? Your answer would be some form of, well, these are the good guys. These are the ones who get the great outcomes. These are the blessed ones. Now, I can almost imagine somebody coming and seeing the pictures that you have up in the room of your soul. You have pictures of some who mourn, pictures of some who hunger and thirst for righteousness, pictures of someone who's gentle. And that person sees those pictures that you have hanging up and they say something like this, well, of course, you're welcome to hang up whatever you want. But it's important that you not start thinking that such folks as you have hanging up on the wall really matter. Really make much of a difference. If you want, you can admire the merciful. If you want, you can hang up a picture of somebody who's persecuted for righteousness' sake. But the merciful folks and the persecuted folks don't matter much in the world. It's if you choose, you can enjoy and admire Little League. You're welcome to do that. But don't imagine that what you're watching really matters very much. It's not the big league, it's just Little League. So I can imagine somebody saying something like that. Do you want to admire the poor in spirit? Do you want to admire those who mourn? If you want to enjoy the gentle person, if you want to enjoy the merciful person, no problem. But they are not the makers of history. They are not the people who make a difference in the world. So these are the very next words that Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount after giving the Beatitudes. We'll put the first one up on the screen. Matthew 5, verse 13. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has become tasteless, how shall it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. Next verse, you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. In Greek, when you want a sentence to start with a personal pronoun, I, we, you, he, she, it, it's not necessary to write out or to give the pronoun. The person and the number, and if it's third person, the gender too, can be picked up by the ending that's on the verb. So you don't have to say the personal pronoun. In fact, the usual method of writing Greek is not to state the pronoun because it's right there in the ending on the verb. So when the pronoun is stated, it's there for emphasis, because it's not needed. So when the personal pronoun is stated, it's a way to give emphasis in Greek. In verse 13 of Matthew chapter 5, and in verse 14, Jesus states, in fact, it's the first word in the sentence, which is also a way to emphasize in Greek, since it's an inflected language and word order doesn't work like it does in English. So to put the word first, you can emphasize the word. So Jesus puts it first, and also he says second person plural, a pronoun, when he doesn't have to because it's in the verb, but he states the second person pronoun. He says, you. And it's emphasized. So he says, you are the salt of the earth. And in the next verse he says, you are the light of the world. Now Jesus issues warnings concerning being salt. And he issues a command and exhortation concerning being light. And we'll get to that warning and the exhortation in a moment. But first, I want to start with just a simple question. And the question is, do you think Jesus is right? Do you believe what it is that he says here? Jesus just gave us a list of the blessed ones. It's not a list that most people would think matter very much. We might think the people on the list, they're nice people. The world might be a nicer place if there are more of them. But they are not the people that are in the halls of power. You know, they're not walking the red carpet. They're not being written up in the history books. They're not the determiners of history. They're not the ones who are setting the trends. They're not the movers and the shakers. Those ones on Jesus' blessed list, they are not the ones making much of a difference. They're not the ones showing the way. And then Jesus says to those folks, you are the salt of the earth, and you are the light of the world. So I want you to imagine Jesus coming here to LCF. And I want him imagine him saying to you, or saying to us, to you all, if Jesus stood up here and says, you are the salt of the earth. And imagine him saying to you, you all are the light of the world. You would have to decide whether you believe him or not. You know, or is he just, he's patronizing us. He's trying to grow the church, make it bigger, and so you're going to be positive and upbeat. The CEO has to be like that when he comes to see his people, get them enthusiastic, rally around the project. So he's just being kind of patronizing to us. Or he's exaggerating a little bit. Not really that big. I mean, we're kind of a small group, you know, not that important. So he's hyperbole, got some exaggeration in it. Or maybe it's just idle chatter. It's just how speakers open their start off, win their audience over, icebreaker type of thing. So if Jesus said to us, you are the salt of the earth, you are the light of the world, would it be something like that? Or is it true? Is it Jesus' followers who preserve and season? Thinking about salt. You know, is it Jesus' followers who help keep things from going bad? Who help prevent things from getting rotten or from decaying? Is it Jesus' followers who also bring out the true flavor of something? Help the thing be like it's supposed to be? Or is it Jesus' followers who make things tasty and spicy, interesting? And is it Jesus' followers who are the ones who illumine and who direct? Or is it Jesus' followers who help everybody see what the deal really is? You know, help us to see what is actually there. What's the purpose of things? What is indeed that's happening? Is it the followers of Jesus who help show what the path should be? Who show us where to go? Help us know how to live? And what do you think about the scope of what Jesus said? The earth. Salt of the earth. And light of the world. I mean, that's a pretty big scope. Right? I mean, and imagine Jesus saying it there in the Sermon on the Mount. Here's a little group of people in a second-rate country. So it's not a very prestigious country. It's not a very powerful country. And this country's occupied by the Romans. So it's just this little group in the second-rate country that's been overrun and is now controlled by the Romans. Do they have significance for the whole earth? Do they matter to the world? I think the usual problem that people have this is my opinion, is that people usually are in fact a lot smaller than they think themselves to be. So often you're trying to get people to realize they're littler than they think they are. One of the things I greatly enjoyed the years when I was a flaming cart chef and I cooked alongside tables. I would come alongside the table and cook right at the table that you could hear these people talking while you cooked next to them. It was a high-end restaurant, a lot of businessmen, and I got a kick out of pushing up to a table where there's six business guys talking and you're cooking for them and you're overhearing the conversation, and you pretty soon you find out just by hearing the conversation that these six guys are running Grand Rapids, Michigan. I mean, this is the power broking team right here, right in front of me. You know, eating dinner in my restaurant. These folks are running Grand Rapids. And then I'd finish that dinner and I'd push the cart across the restaurant to another group of four who were sitting there. And I'd hear the conversation a little bit, and then I'd find out, here are the four people who are running Grand Rapids. Sometimes the devious part of me, I always want to go, you guys should get together, because there's another group over there that's running the town too. You should just get together and do a unified plan. But it was almost entertaining. It was like comical. All these, and they were wealthy, influential people, granted. But they all had the perspective of themselves, like, we're the people. You know, we're running this town. And of course, from the perspective of California now, how big a deal, even if they were running Grand Rapids, Michigan, how big a deal is that? Where's that again? So even if they were, that's not like all that big a deal. So usually, our usual problem is, you know, we're perhaps also often a lot smaller than we're making ourselves out to be. But here, Jesus makes who his followers are and what they are really big, if he's right. He makes them the salt of the earth. He makes them the light of the world. You might also note, if you're a Bible student here, it's remarkable that Jesus is saying to his disciples what's usually just said of the nation of Israel. Israel's the chosen people of God. They're supposed to be light. They're supposed to be salt. They're supposed to be a blessing to all the nations of the world. And now Jesus is saying that not to the nation of Israel, he's saying that to his followers, to his disciples. Saying, you are the ones who are salt. You are the ones who are light. So Jesus is kind of transferring what Israel thought was true of themselves as a chosen people, and Jesus is saying it's true of his followers. You know, we talk nowadays, I don't know if you ever hear these circles, but there's talk nowadays about what's called American exceptionalism. And it's the debate about whether America as a country is different than other countries, whether it's special in some ways, whether it's unique, whether it's exceptional, whether it has some type of special role to play on the world stage. Some say yes to that. Some say America is to be the city set on a hill. That's taken right from the passage we just read, that America should be that beacon of liberty and of hope to the whole earth. So they want to say, yes, America is an exceptional, and it's got to take seriously that role, that it has to be a light. You know, others say that's just arrogance, that's American arrogance, and that's silliness. America isn't any more exceptional than any other country. We're just like everybody else. To think otherwise is just foolish, almost funny. Jesus is saying, though, for sure, that his followers are exceptional. My own view is America probably has an important role to play in the world. But I do not think it's true to say that America is a city set on a hill. I do think you are a city set on a hill. I do think you are the light of the world. So I'm just wanting us to consider, if what Jesus says here in the Sermon on the Mount is part of our understanding and is part of what we're convinced of and part of our own convictions, I'm not asking what will you do if you believe it's true. How will you apply it? I'm not asking that. Okay, if you believe it's true, you should evangelize more, you should criticize more, you should do something more or less. I'm not asking you to think about what you will do. I'm just asking you to consider, do you think it's true? And I'm not asking you if you think it's true for me or it's important in my life. Jesus things are important in my life. It's the way I was raised. So I'm most comfortable following the things that I was raised in and been told my whole life. I'm not asking that. I'm asking if you believe that the followers of Jesus are the salt of the earth. If the followers of Jesus are the light of the world. We live in a time that shies away from any claims to universal truth. If you're in the academic world, you know that for sure. Truth is almost always put in quotes nowadays. It's got parentheses around it. Because its truth just means your own private truth, your private story. Things that are true for you, things that are true in your own narrative, in your own worldview or whatever. But if you make truth claims for the whole earth, you make some claim for truth that applies to all of the world, that our time doesn't believe there is such a, it's called a meta-narrative, if you know the lingo. Like there is no overarching truth for all the cultures everywhere in the whole world. You know, that's seen as either silliness, arrogance, our own imperialistic intentions to impose our views and our understanding on others, stuff like that. Yet Jesus is clearly making a global claim about his followers. And I'm asking you to consider, do you believe him? Or is it something else? Exaggeration, patronizing, hyperbole. When Jesus says that first thing, says you are the salt of the earth, he also issues a warning with it. He says if the salt loses its saltiness, two things happen. First, it can't regain its saltiness. That's kind of a sobering thing. You can't be salty one day, not salty the next day, then salty again the day after that, and then not salty again. You can't go back and forth. If you lose your saltiness, how can it be regained? Can't be recaptured. And if it does lose its saltiness, the second thing he says, it's no longer good for anything. It's not good for its purpose. It's worthless, can only be thrown out and trampled underfoot. I very much think the issue for us, the issue for the followers of Jesus, the issue is not whether or not we are really the salt of the earth. I think what Jesus said is true. I think his followers are the salt of the earth. The issue for us is whether or not we retain our saltiness. That's the issue. And saltiness is not something that others steal from us. It's not like others could persecute us and steal from us our saltiness. Rather, saltiness is something that we would surrender ourselves. We give it up. So Jesus warns about that which is salty becoming unsalty. And he warns, careful if that happens, you can't regain it. How can it be made salty again? And also, then now it's not good for the purposes for which it was designed. It can't preserve, it can't flavor, it can't season, it can't do other things, throw it out. When Jesus says the second thing about his followers being light of the world, that comes with an exhortation, comes with a command. He says, let your light shine. And notice the shining is done by means of good works. Shining is expressed by how we live, by things that we do, by the relationships that we keep. It's no more different than you know them by their fruit. So it's not let our light shine by passing around our doctrinal statement. People have to see what it is that we do, the works that we do, and whether they're good or not. And here's another example, we're going to hit it a lot, that for Matthew, righteousness is connected to what you do, because it's showing up in good works. But how we live, individually, how we live together, it should be a bright spot in our world. Should be a light. Should be like a city set on a hill. So Jesus issues both that warning about those who are salt and that exhortation to those who are light. And of course, you probably already know this, but remember, to say that Jesus' followers are salt, to say that Jesus' followers are light, is ultimately to say something about Jesus himself. So if you believe that his followers can be the salt of the earth and the light of the world, ultimately that's saying that Jesus is the one who brings the salt to the earth and the light to the world. So I want to come back to those things in just a moment, but I also want us just to note the next verses that are in Matthew 5. So after Jesus says that very emphatic "you" to his followers, here are the next verses. He says, "Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished. Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven." Very great verses, very significant verses, far-reaching, actually, I think, in their implication. But let's handle them kind of simple and directly. I think we should take these verses as a setup from Jesus. A setup, not in the sense of he's trying to trick us or deceive us, mislead us somehow, but a setup in the sense, if you heed the setup, it'll help keep us on track. It'll help lay some groundwork, so it helps us so that we don't lose our bearings, get confused, wander off on needless rabbit trails. So I think Jesus is saying something here that we should take as a setup. And the setup is this: Jesus wants us to know that, kind of like, whatever you see after this, whatever you hear after this, whatever you're tempted to think as we go forward, he says, I want you to know. I want you to know for sure that I am not about abolishing the law. Whatever you see, whatever you hear, whatever happens, I want you to know I am not about abolishing the law. Rather, I am about fulfilling the law. It's also very important to remember, as Jesus says that, though Israel had the law, and often Israel, the people, they were very zealous for the law, it's important for you to know that they were not fulfilling it. If they had been fulfilling it, Jesus would not have needed to have died. To use a phrase, if righteousness can come through the law, Jesus Christ died needlessly. So they had the law, they were often zealous for it. Stephen finishes his speech in Acts chapter 7 with, "You who had the law as ordained by angels and yet did not keep it." And that's his summary statement as he's recounted the whole history of Israel as the nation of the chosen people of God. "You who had the law as ordained by angels and yet did not keep it." And then they proceeded to stone him to death because they didn't fully agree with that statement. But confirming actually what he had just said by doing so, right? So Israel had the law, they were zealous for it, but they weren't fulfilling it. And so Jesus comes and says, I want you to get this settled. I want you to get this straight, that I am here to fulfill it. That's something that has not happened. That's why I'm here. I'm here to fulfill it. I think it's important for us to hear him say, I'm not here to abolish it. So if you've ever gone to the chiropractor, you know, they put you on that table and flip you down, they're going to mess with your neck or something, your back, you know, and you're laying there all vulnerable, and the chiropractor puts hands on you and says, "Now just relax. I'm not trying to hurt you." Why do they say, "I'm not trying to hurt you"? Yeah, because it feels like he's about ready to break your neck, right? You know, you oops. You know, you don't want to hear that. And that's common, right? So he says, "Don't think I'm trying to hurt you. You know, it looks like a very vulnerable position where I could just, you know, bust your back, but I'm not trying to hurt you." So why do you think Jesus says, Don't think I've come to abolish the law. Why does he say that? Well, if you don't know, you can just read a little bit farther in Matthew chapter 5, and we'll get to it next week. But the next words out of Jesus' mouth is, you've heard that it was said. And he quotes Scripture. But I say unto you, and he trumps Scripture. How do you spell abolish? So Jesus is going to say some things, and he's going to do some things. And Jesus' followers, by the way, also are going to say some things and do some things that if you didn't get the setup, well, you're thinking, that's nullifying the law. That's not, it's abolishing it. And Jesus says to them, get this straight right from the beginning. I'm not here to abolish it. I'm here to fulfill it. I mean, it's important for us to hear that so that you don't freak out in a little bit of saying, oh, look at it, it's being abolished. My own view is that the path to fulfillment of the law just runs in such wonderful ways and down paths that are so unanticipated by us that it's hard for us not to conclude that it's being abolished. That's why the Apostle Paul also has to say, do we then nullify the law? By no means. We don't nullify it, we fulfill it. Well, Jesus says that here right at the start. And if we can get that in our heads, that's to our advantage, that he's here to fulfill it. Get that settled, get it straight. The issue is not going to be, how do we circumvent the law? We've never been able to do it very well. So how do we get around it a little bit? Maybe we can cut the Ten Commandments down to 7, so they're not quite so demanding or something like that. But the issue isn't circumventing it. The issue is, how do you fulfill it? And Jesus says, that's why I'm here. But be warned that the path to fulfillment might be different than you think. And then just finally this, for us to know that the kingdom is a place where the law is fulfilled. The kingdom is a place where there is righteousness. So if you want to be a kingdom person, if I want to be a kingdom person, you have to be righteous. Take note, it doesn't say it's okay if you're sorry for not being righteous, that'll get you in. It doesn't say that. If you're not righteous, it's maybe a good idea to be sorry for that, but you still don't get in. The kingdom is a place you only get in if you're righteous. Kingdom is a place where the law is fulfilled. And you have to be more righteous than the scribes and the Pharisees. Unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you won't enter the kingdom. I don't know if that strikes you, but you have to know that puts the bar pretty high. Because the scribes and the Pharisees, they were the most righteous people that anybody knew about. They're the most righteous folks around. And Jesus says, you want to enter the kingdom, you got to do better than them. It's like saying to Greg, if you really want to investigate other planets, you got to do a lot better than that thing you got up there now. So that's the best we got. So Jesus identifies those who are the most righteous, the most zealous for the law, the most serious about it, the most competent in it, and he says, got to do better than that. You have to fulfill it if you want to enter the kingdom. So there's something about that that's pretty daunting. That also goes with him saying, I'm here to fulfill it. I'm here to make possible a righteousness that nobody's known, that nobody currently has. So I want us to just take these words as like a setup and get them settled in your mind and your heart that Jesus is here not to abolish the law, not to lessen it somehow, not to annul some part of it that everybody has trouble doing. He's here to fulfill it. And the issue is it needs to be fulfilled. The righteousness that it points to needs to be known and walked in if we're going to be a kingdom people. Because that's where the kingdom of heaven operates. It operates with righteousness. So things to believe and things to know. I think it would be easy to dismiss Jesus' followers as nice but not too significant. It would probably be easy at the time. 12 fishermen standing on the side of a mountain. on a second-rate country occupied by the Romans. How important are those guys? It'd also be easy to dismiss Jesus' followers now. A little group of us gathered here in the room on a hot Sunday afternoon, how important are them? And against that, to hear Jesus say to his followers, to hear him give to his followers global weight and purpose, and to say to his disciples then, to say to us now, you are the salt of the earth, and you are the light of the world. Don't lose your saltiness, and let your light shine. So do you believe that? And also then to know that this deal of being Jesus' followers, it's not about nullifying the law, not about abolishing the law. Rather, it's about the fulfillment of it. It's about a righteousness that's beyond the reach of those who were most serious and most committed at the time. That's what the fulfillment of the law is about. And Jesus is here to bring that, get that settled in your mind about as far as what he's about. So after this, Jesus goes on now to give a bunch of teaching that I think applies to his way, his purpose, how the kingdom of heaven works. And we'll be looking at those things. I try to emphasize this in such a way that I don't want you to think too much of what do we do? How do we make application of it? But rather, just do you think it's true? I think that if we believe it, it'll find the expression that it ought to find in our lives. But if you're like me, you feel a certain reluctance to say, yeah, you know, we are the light of the world. We're the salt of the earth. You know, we feel like what we're doing is important, but there's many cultures and many ways of thinking about metaphysical things, and lots of other folks think that work differently, and everybody has little traces of pinpoints of light or things to add to the discussion. Isn't it silly? Isn't it presumptuous? Isn't it arrogant for you guys to think that you're the salt of the earth? That you're the light of the world? And then we back away from it. But what if it's true? I think believing it doesn't make you proud. I think actually believing it stirs humility in us. And Jesus said to us, contact the earth, you're its salt. Preserve. Season. Keep it from rotting. Keep it from going astray. You know, be that which helps it see what it's supposed to be and tastes like what it's supposed to take like and help it be from so insipid. Make it tasty and interesting, and you're the light. It'll be lost in darkness without the Lord's followers. No other name given under heaven by which men can be saved. So you're its light. And, you know, so maybe you just walk down the street and talk to your neighbor next door. Maybe he's got a bigger house than you, a nicer car, makes a lot more money, has a lot more influence in the community, doesn't know the Lord. You have to know, for that person I'm salt. And for that person I'm light. Well, maybe you go to work. You sit in a bunch of meetings or do all kinds of things and interact with all kinds of people. You have to, some of whom are over you on the org chart, some of you some who are under you, you have to know, here, I'm the salt of the earth. You know, I'm the light of the world. Whatever, I don't know what that maybe perhaps would mean, but you have to know that that's who you are. They need to see our good works. And they need to encounter the salt.